Another day, another talk. It's a story of my life. So when everyone is sitting comfortably, then we'll begin. Just while I'm waiting for everyone to settle down, I hope everyone is following the instructions. I hope everyone especially is practicing that meditation at the beginning of the day. When you first go to the toilet, you look in your face in a mirror and smile. And if you can't manage an ordinary smile, get out your two fingers. Please do that, because it starts the day with happiness. And I just got into the habit of that now. Whenever I pass a mirror, I just smile at myself. So I always laugh at myself when I pass mirrors. It's a marvelous way to start the day, to give happiness into your life, and especially happiness into your meditation. Now, the talk today is actually talking about the hindrances, because these morning talks, we get into the nuts and bolts of meditation. And this is when those nuts and bolts seize up, when they go rusty, when you can't turn them, when there's a problem, a difficulty in the meditation. And the Buddha, the great teacher, very clearly, very precisely, saw what those problems are and gave you a troubleshooting list. If you have any problems in the meditation, you have the five hindrances as a list for troubleshooting. If there's any problem in your meditation, it must be, it has to be, one or more of these five hindrances. So you have to know what these five hindrances are, to know them, to be able to recognize them, to know how to deal with them, and that way you'll know everything there is to know about meditation. And also, there'll be nothing between you and the jhanas. The only obstacle, the Buddha said, the only barrier to stopping you attaining these bliss states is one or more of these five hindrances. And as I think I said last night, it's the five hindrances which bend the truth of things, which stop you seeing things as they truly are. And I'm going to mention more about that in the talk which I give on Deep Insight in a couple of days' time. How you need to overcome these five hindrances. Otherwise, you just cannot trust what you experience. It is not the truth, because it's been bent according to your views, your likes and dislikes. But today I'm going to especially focus on what these five hindrances are in the context of meditation and why they stop you letting go. Each of these five hindrances is a form of attachment, which is why the path of meditation as taught here uncovers the roots of attachment, the five hindrances, uncovers them, cuts them off, because when the roots are cut off, then the tree of craving dies. And then you're enlightened, free, at liberty at last. So what are those five hindrances? Those of you who think you know these things, please listen carefully. If you truly did know everything about the five hindrances, you would be someone who attains jhana at ease without any problem. You'd be just sitting here with enormous smiles on your face for hours and hours and hours. If you can't do that, it means you haven't fully understood the five hindrances yet. So, listen carefully. You may find what is your obstacle, what is the barrier to you attaining these deep meditations. The first hindrance is concern for the five senses. The second hindrance is ill will. The third hindrance is sloth and torpor. The fourth hindrance is restlessness and remorse, and the fifth hindrance is doubt. That's in brief. The first hindrance is the big one. That is the hardest one to overcome, which is why it's put number one on the Buddha's list. Karmachanda. The consent, the interest in the world of the five senses. It's important to know this description of the sense world by the Buddha. It's the world of the five senses. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. and is the world of the mind, the sixth sense. The Buddha made a very clear distinction between those senses and saying that the way of meditation is to let go of those five senses, to allow them to disappear. And with their disappearance comes the disappearance of any perception of your body and the appearance of the mind. Now, why is it that when there's a sound, we can't let it go? What is that sound to do with us? It might be the sound of a traffic. It might be the sound of the mosque. It might be the sound of somebody else coughing or making a noise. Why can't we just not listen to it? The reason is because you are attached to that sound. You can't let it go because there's a craving to hear. This is the deep attachment we're talking about, the hindrance which ties you to the realm of the five senses. Why is it that when you're sitting down you get an itch in the body, you get a pain, an ache? Why can't you let it go? Why can't you just turn off the switch of touching so you can't feel it anymore? The reason is because you're attached to the feelings in the body. Because you crave to feel in the body. That is why. Especially when it's painful. When it's painful, doesn't it make sense just to let it go, turn off, and don't even know it anymore? Why can't we do that at will? Because we're attached even to pain. That's why when people used to ask Ajahn Chah, can't we sit meditation in a quieter place? Can't you tell those villagers not to play their music so loud? Can't you tell those little crickets not to make so much noise in the monastery? And of course Ajahn Chah said, it's not the sound disturbing you. You disturb the sound. It's not the body, the pain disturbs you. You disturb the pain. You turn on that bodily switch and listen to it. It's like a person with a radio. You can turn that radio off if you know how, but sometimes people don't want to turn the radio off. You see them in cars listening to the radio on the way to work. You see them walking or jogging with a Walkman on their head listening to something or other. They just, even in the lifts, in the airports, on the aeroplane, there's always music. Why do people want that? Because they're attached to sound, to hearing. To actually overcome this first hindrance is the most difficult. To be able to learn how to turn off sight, sound, smell, taste, and even physical touch, so we can't hear anymore. We can't feel the body anymore. Things disappear. With the five senses disappearing, the whole body disappears. It's called letting go. The reason why we can't let go is attachment. That attachment usually manifests as interest. When someone is speaking, we're interested in what they are saying. When there's a noise outside, we're interested to find out what that noise is. When there's a feeling in the body, we're interested to try and know that feeling. Instead of just letting it go, knowing it's somebody else's business. When you have pain, it doesn't bother me. I don't feel it, because it's your body, not mine. When you hear a sound, I'm not concerned. It's your ears hearing this, not mine. I use that metaphor to let go of my sound and my feelings. All this sound, it's not mine, just arises and passes away, nothing to do with me. Therefore, I don't even pay attention to it. Feelings in the body, this body, is not me, it's not mine. I just got this body from my mother, I'd have to give it up again after a few years. It doesn't belong to me, why should I worry about it? It's like your body, I can let it go. If you can let go of feelings and sounds, as well as sights, tastes and touches, you know how to let go of this most important first hindrance of concern for the sensory world. The way of letting go of that sensory world is a path of meditation. This path of meditation is very skillful. It lets go of the sensory world stage by stage. It's just too frightening to let go all in one go. So you close your eyes so you can let go of seeing. That's why it's important to close your eyes in meditation. If you keep your eyes open, you'll get distracted. You'll never be able to turn off the sense of sight. When you first close your eyes, you see blackness. The thing is, if the blackness doesn't move, if you don't open your eyes again, then the sense of sight turns off. Because the five senses are only able to work when there is change. It's the same with hearing. If there's a constant sound, it doesn't matter how loud or how soft that sound is. If there's a constant sound, after a while, the ears don't hear it. All the senses depend upon change, alteration, for consciousness to arise. It's why we try and sit still, because when the body doesn't move, after a while, it disappears. Because even physical touch can only recognize change. So the way of turning off these five senses is to create stillness in our body, stillness in our world. However, it's just so hard to create absolute stillness. Even in the quietest of places, there's still the noise of your breathing. There's still the sound somewhere around. So there comes a time when even though we sit still in quiet places, still we need something else to turn off the five senses, to let them go until they're no longer there. So we have these meditation objects, such as the breath. We focus on this breath. That breath is a feeling, a physical feeling. It's a sense of touch. But we only have that one sense of touch. So we can let go of all other senses of touch. We have that one sense of touch, so we can let go of all hearing. We have that one sense of touch, so we can get all about smelling, tasting, and seeing. For many, we go to one. Ekagata, one pointedness of mind, just with the breath. There's a simile which I give, which actually comes from the Hindu tradition, of the archers learning meditation through the practice of archery. One day the teacher decides to give them a test to see if they really understand one pointedness of mind. He puts a stuffed bird on a branch of a tree a long way away, and he tells the archers, I want you to shoot the arrow through the left eyeball of that bird, not through the head, not through the wings, not through the body, but just not even the right eyeball, it has to go through the left eyeball. The only way you can achieve such a feat of archery is to make yourself one with the target. One pointedness of mind is the key. So he gives a bow and arrow to his first student and says, meditate. Make your mind one pointed with the target, but before you shoot, give me a sign. So this young student takes the bow and arrow, aims, concentrates, and just before he's about to shoot, he gives a sign to the master after half an hour of concentration. And the master asks him, can you see the bird on the tree? Student said, yes, master. Stupid student. And he pushes the student away, grabs a bow and arrow, and tells him to go and learn some more meditation. He gives the bow and arrow to the second student. Same instructions. You have to shoot that bird through its left eyeball. Make yourself one with the target. Concentrate. When you're ready, give me a sign. This student takes one whole hour of concentration before he makes a sign to his master that he's ready to shoot. The master asks him the same question. Student, can you see the bird on a tree? And the student says, what tree? Can you see the bird? Said the master, interested. Yes, stupid student. Pushed him away, took the bow and arrow, and gave it to the third student. That third student, with the same instruction, took 2 hours of concentration. making himself one with the target before he gave a sign to his master. And the master asked him the same questions. Can you see the bird on the tree? What tree, master? Can you see the bird? What bird? Ah, said the teacher, what can you see? All I can see, said the student, is an eyeball. Just an eyeball, nothing more. And the teacher smiled and said, shoot. That was the only thing he could see. That was the only thing the arrow could go through. And that's what it did go through. This is the story of focusing, of letting go of everything else but the object of your attention. When you focus on the breath, after a while, the rest of the world disappears, and all you've got left is the breath. Sounds disappear, feelings disappear, just like the tree and the rest of the bird disappeared, only leaving the eyeball. In this meditation, that's what you're doing. It's not that hard. Many of you can watch the television, a movie, the soccer, and everything else in the world completely disappears. And all you left is just watching the movie, just like the eyeball. That's all that's left. I like the simile of watching a television because if you look at a television, notice when you first turn it on, you can see what's on top of the television. You can see the magazines underneath. You can see the sides of the screen, the edges. But after a while, doesn't matter how big or small that screen is, after a while, all you can see is what's on the center of the screen. And you lose all perception of the edges of your TV screen. It is because we lose perception of the edges that the TV series or the movie appears real. Notice when you're watching a TV or when you're watching a movie, all your perception of the edges and what's beyond those edges completely vanishes. Your focus. In the same way, when you're meditating, all you have is the breath, just the breath, nothing but the breath. Everything else which was on the edges of the screen of your consciousness has disappeared. First of all, you put the breath in the center. You might be aware of the body. You might be aware of sounds. You might be even aware of thoughts. But when you focus on the breath more and more, after a while, that's all that's left, just the breath. There you've got rid of the 99% of the first hindrance, when all you have left is the breath, just the breath and nothing but the breath. You're watching the breath there and there's nothing else comes into your mind. You can't hear sounds, you can't feel the body. Some people have been commenting, both in KL and here, when the body starts to disappear, when you can't feel your hands or your legs, you start to get afraid. All fear when it comes up is a good sign. It's a sign that you're confronting your attachments. Because when we're about to let go of our possessions, that's when we feel fear. All fear comes from the idea that this is mine, and we're about to lose something we thought was mine. Its fear shows us we're challenging our attachments. Fear is part of the path. But instead of just reacting by receding from fear, we're strong, we're courageous, we have faith. We just stay there and see what happens next. Because every time you let go of an attachment, every time you go through that fear, there's only peace and freedom comes afterwards. But don't be afraid if fear comes up to you. As I said to somebody last night, in the suttas, the Buddha said he had fear. He had fear of the pleasures of meditation. Until he realized that why should I be afraid of these pleasures which have nothing to do with unwholesome qualities? I shall not be afraid, said the Buddha. And afterwards he sat under the Bodhi tree and became fully enlightened. So if you experience fear in your meditation when things start to disappear, remember, you're in good company. Even the Bodhisattva, the Buddha-to-be, had that fear. So, well done. You're treading in the footprints of the Buddha. So when fear comes up, stay. Don't recede. It's only fear of letting go of something which doesn't belong to you. The body doesn't belong to you, but when it starts to disappear, then you realize how it's not essential to you. When you can't feel your body, when you can't hear the sounds around you, don't worry, this is good, because this is where peace and happiness truly start to arise. When you let go of attachments, you just get more happy, that's all. The freedom from attachments is nirvana, the ultimate happiness. It's like walking along a road with a backpack full of stones, with suitcases, and with a big bundle on top of your head as well. It's so heavy, you have to drag yourself along under the weight of so many possessions. Every time you throw something out, you feel lighter. When you take a stone out of the backpack from your back, it feels lighter. When you throw the whole backpack out, it feels lighter. When you put the suitcases down, it feels lighter. When you take off the burden on top of your head, it feels lighter. When you've got no burdens, you skip along, happy, free. You're like a bird, the symbol of freedom. Birds, when they fly in the sky, I never yet once seen a bird carrying suitcases. I never once seen a bird with a backpack, not even with a money belt, like many people have. Birds fly free with no burdens. This lack of attachments, giving up. So here, we get to the stage where all we've got left is the breath. We've abandoned so much of our body, we can't feel it. We don't know where our hands are. We can't hear anything. Now we've got to go a bit deeper. The hindrances haven't gone yet. The first hindrance is still there because we've still got our breath. The next stage is when the breath disappears. And that's when people get afraid again, because they think that something personal is now gone. Do not be afraid. In all the years I've been teaching meditation, not yet has anyone died during a meditation retreat. So you don't have to worry, but even if you do, because you're here, I'll give you a cheap funeral. Special discount, because you're a meditator. But don't worry, you will not die on a retreat. Even if you think you're stopping breathing, you're not stopping breathing. It is just a physical sense of touch has disappeared. The last part of the five senses is gone. You're experiencing your breath not as a physical feeling, not through the sense of touch. You are now experiencing the breath through the sense of mind. When the breath, so-called, disappears, it's only the physical sensation of the breath disappears. You're left with how the mind knows the breath. This is a mental perception, not a physical perception. That's why it changes its appearance, why sometimes people can't recognize that the breath is still there, but now you are knowing the breath rather than feeling the breath. It is for this reason I encourage people not to locate the breath anywhere on the body, especially on the deep stages of meditation. Don't concern yourself whether the breath is at the tip of the nose or the belly or anywhere, because the tip of the nose has to disappear, so does the belly, to go into deeper stages of meditation. You know the breath, not the place where it manifests. You're not washing the body, you're washing the breath, and the breath changes to a mental breath. So you haven't got a clue where on that body the breath is being felt. You cannot even feel any part of your body. You're deep within, just knowing the breath, knowing the breath, knowing the breath. And your body has completely gone. At this stage there'll always be a great deal of happiness, great deal of joy. The reason is because you've let go of the burden of the body and the five senses. It's only when you can't feel the body anymore, you can't hear sounds, only then do you know that first hindrance has been abandoned. You've let go of your body. It's disappeared. You've let go of the five senses. everything is quiet. You can't feel the body anymore. When I was in Thailand the first year or two, I had to practice this because of one of my great teachers. You know, Ajahn means teacher. Ajahn Mosquito taught me how to let go of my body. Because in those first years, the first weeks I was a monk, Ajahn Chah sent six of us to start Wat Nana Chat, where many Western monks now live. In those early days, there wasn't any huts, there wasn't any kitchens, there wasn't any toilets, there wasn't any hall. We were just camping out in the jungle. And in the evening, Ajahn Chah would come over to do some evening chanting, give a talk and sit meditation. It was a very, very bad time of the day to do meditation. It was at dusk, under the trees, without any mosquito coils, no mosquito repellent. You didn't have that stuff in those days. And that was a time when all the mosquitoes came out. The worst time of the day, without any protection. And those Thai mosquitoes were special. They had been genetically inbred to recognize the brown robe as a safe meal. If they tried to bite somebody who was wearing trousers or a skirt or sarong, they knew it was very dangerous. They'd get swatted. But if they saw something brown, they knew that was safe. Genetic conditioning meant the mosquitoes loved monks. Not only that, but monks, because of their bald heads and bare shoulders, they gave more seats at the table, so to speak, for dinner. More mozzies could land on you. And lastly, I was a Westerner. The mozzies had been used to Thai food. Now they had Western food. It was a novelty, and many of them enjoyed it. So those mosquitoes, my goodness, they gave us torture. Many of them would land on you at once, and they were so irritating. You'd open your eyes and get up to run away. But then you'd see Ajahn Chah sitting there, and you were too scared to run away. You had to stick it out, and my goodness, it was tough. With another monk, we used to play this game together. He was also the same, just only a month or two junior to me. We used to count the mosquitoes on our arm. We'd get to 60 or 70, this is at the same time, before we couldn't count them anymore. They were so close together, you couldn't distinguish the bites. They were so irritating, so hard to endure. The only way that I could endure that was to watch my breath. I wouldn't dare let my mindfulness wander away from my breath. Because if it did, it would go straight to my arm. And I'd feel all this terrible irritation and itching, which I just couldn't stand. The mosquitoes, Ajahn Mosquito, taught me how to keep my attention still. And after a while, you'd be watching the breath would disappear, you go into lovely states of meditation, all because of Ajahn Mosquito. And I couldn't feel my body. It had disappeared and gone. I couldn't feel the heat. You couldn't hear anything. You're in meditation. You let go. That was the way I survived the mosquitoes in those early days. It taught me what's possible when you let go of your body. And you don't need to be afraid. Because a strange thing happened. I found another reason. I thought it was actually something psychic, first of all. Because when I used to get into deep meditation that way, under the trees, when I came out, there was no bumps or, you know, the remnants from a mosquito bite. If a mosquito bites you, you always got a little bump there afterwards, a little raised, itchy spot. But there was no bumps at all. Even though I didn't even try and fight the mosquitoes, they can land upon me and bite me as much as they would. None of them bit me when I was in meditation. I thought that when you're in meditation, it must be some sort of power field, the mosquitoes can't get close to you. But I found only a year or two ago, reading a scientific journal, mosquitoes are attracted to the carbon dioxide coming out of your pores. The more, the higher your metabolism, the more mosquitoes come, no, more carbon dioxide comes out, the more visible you are and more attractive you are to mosquitoes. So when your metabolism goes down, when you get very still in meditation, hardly any carbon dioxide comes out at all, and you become invisible to the mosquitoes. It's because of stillness, the mosquitoes didn't know where I was. They couldn't find me. That's how you protect yourself from mosquitoes. The people who worry, mosquito. Your metabolism goes up because you worry, and that's why the mosquitoes can find you. And that is the reason, this scientific truth which I found out, which I should really get a Nobel Prize for. You know that's why mosquitoes buzz in your ear before they bite? You know why they do that? They want to make you worried and concerned. Because when they make you worried and concerned, then you have a greater metabolism and they can find you more. So, if you don't get worried, if you don't get concerned, then they may buzz in your ear as much as they like, but still they can't find you. You're invisible, the less concerned you are. So this was actually telling me how to let go of that first hindrance of sensory desire. And when you let go of that hindrance, all you've got is either the beautiful breath. It's not really a breath anymore. You don't know it's the breath. It's just the mind knowing the breath. And that soon turns into the nimitta, beautiful light which appears in the mind. Once you have that beautiful light in the mind and you can't hear any sound, you can't feel your body, then you know that hindrance of sensual desire has been overcome. Before then, you don't realize how deep and profound is sensory attachment, how attached you are to your body. People think, even Buddhists think, I'm not attached to my body, I'm going to die, I know that, I've reflected upon that again and again, but when the time comes, you don't realize how attached you are. There's this man monk. The story was told to me by Ajahn Juan, one of the Thai forest monks. He was a wandering monk, this monk, and he became known as the monk who wasn't afraid of tigers. Because he went to a village one day, and he just gave a little sermon saying how he'd overcome his fear of tigers. And the villagers said, yeah. He said, yeah. He said, really? Okay, we'll test you, said the villagers. Because there was a tiger who was raiding their village, killing their water buffalo. And they knew the tiger's path. They could see it through the jungle close to the village. So they took that monk and put his mosquito net and the little table right next to the tiger path. Okay, monk, you can meditate all night. We'll see if you're really afraid of tigers or not. He was a meditator, a seasoned monk. He said, I'm not afraid of tigers. This is easy. And so he sat there by the tiger path late into the night. He was a Thai forest monk who did meditation on the breath with the mantra, Buddho, Buddho, Buddho. You've heard about that mantra? With the in-breath, you say Bud, or you think Bud. With the out-breath, To, Buddho, Buddho. It helps you watch the breath. And there he was late in the night, very, very peaceful, very still. Buddho. So still. Buddho. Having a wonderful time. Buddho. With the in and out breath. But then he heard a sound of an animal coming towards him. Buddho. 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 He opened his eyes. Buddho. 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 He saw it was a tiger. No Buddha anymore. Tiger, tiger, tiger. And before he knew it, he didn't know when, but he leapt out of his mosquito net and was running away. Still keeping his mantra, tiger, 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 tiger. Now there's one thing you should know as a monk. You should never run. The reason why it's against your rules to run is because when you start running, these robes start to come loose. And after they become loose, they start falling off. And he was so scared, tiger, 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 that by the time he ran into the village, he had no robes left. He came into the village, the naked monk who wasn't afraid of the tiger, waking everyone in the village up with his mantra, tiger, tiger, tiger. That's a true story which Ajahn Jewett used to tell. The monk wasn't afraid of a tiger. We don't know if we're afraid or not afraid until we see one. We don't know if we're attached to our body until the time comes to give our body up. Then we know. Or we can find out beforehand, are you ready to let go of your body now? To go into a jhana. So the body disappears, the breath disappears. Sight, sound, smells, taste, touches, all disappear. It is like dying, because that's what happens when you do die. When you do die, all the five senses turn off. The body stops. And what happens next is you go to the realm of the mind. You go floating off towards a light. That is the same light, you see, as a nimitta in this stage of meditation. Really, jhana meditation is rehearsing how to die. Same thing happens. Let go of the body, let go of the senses, go to the realm of the mind. They are practicing letting go of the body. Which is why the Buddha said, Anapanasati fulfills body contemplation, mindfulness of the body, the ability to cut the attachment to the body. If you follow this way, you know whether you cut the attachment to the body or not, whether you can get a nimitta and retain that nimitta. That's why this attachment to the senses, attachment to the body, karma chanda, is the hardest of these hindrances to overcome. This is the way you do it, stage by stage. Watching the breath, so all the other senses disappear, only left with the breath. Focusing like you focus on the eye of a bird, so everything else disappears. And then allowing the eyeball to disappear. Allowing the breath to disappear. And going to the realm of the mind. Face fear. Go through that fear, it's just bliss, bliss, bliss all the way. It's just so nice to get a nimitta. So beautiful, so much pleasure to let go of this body. You never feel as comfortable as when this body disappears. You never feel as delightful as when the senses have all stopped. The second hindrance is called ill will. It's number two because it's number two enemy. Ill will goes to many things. It's not just ill will to that person who keeps coughing next to you. It's not just ill will to that person who snored last night. It's not just ill will to Ajahn Brahm. It's not just ill will towards your business colleague who cheated you. That's the easy ill will to overcome. It's the ill will, number one, towards yourself. Number two, towards your mind. Those are the big forms of the ill will hindrance. Ill will towards yourself, again, is very, very deep and profound. Sometimes people don't want to be free because they don't feel they deserve it. We have ill will towards ourselves based on guilt. We feel that we're not pure enough. We don't deserve freedom and happiness. Several years ago, a nun staying at my monastery started to get into deep meditation. She got a nimitta coming up, but she couldn't keep it. And it wasn't fear, it was guilt. She came to me and said, as soon as that nimitta came up, the thought came up, I don't deserve so much happiness. I don't deserve so much bliss. It was a clear insight into her barrier. Very few people allow themselves to be happy. We think we don't deserve happiness, especially that much happiness. You deserve all the happiness in the world. The Buddha wanted you to be happy. Everyone wants you to be free. The door of the prison is open to you. Your sentence is over. Walk out. We don't feel that we've done enough penance yet, so we don't want to walk out of jail. The Buddha said, open are the doors to the deathless. It's like being in a prison, being a prisoner, and the doors are wide open. But people just do not want to walk out into freedom. They don't feel they deserve freedom. Which is why loving kindness is such a powerful meditation. Loving kindness towards yourself. The door of my heart is open to me, no matter what I've ever done. Wishing oneself happiness, wishing oneself freedom, wishing oneself jhana, wishing oneself nirvana. To give you yourself the possibility to be free. If you can't go deeper in meditation, try some loving kindness meditation. You'll be amazed at how powerful it is, because it does overcome a very deep-seated, sometimes subconscious obstacle of self-hatred, of ill will towards oneself, manifested as not allowing oneself to bliss out. Even today, many people say, is this right that we're teaching pleasure in this meditation retreat? Surely we should go for pain, like Vipassana teachings. At least when you feel pain, you feel that you're getting somewhere, because you feel you're torturing yourself, because you feel you deserve to be tortured. Why is it that people feel good when they experience pain? Because of ill will, they think they're assuaging their guilt. They want to suffer, which is why they don't want to be happy. Here in this meditation retreat, I expect more of you than that. I expect you to give yourself the gift of happiness. Don't be torturing yourself. Whatever you've done in the past, forgive, let go. Don't forget. Forgive, let go, learn. So there's no punishment at all. As I said a couple of days ago, the only punishment I give people in my monastery is 50 strokes of the cat. And you all know what 50 strokes of the cat is now. The little cat. Wow, nice cat. Two. That's 2 strokes of the cat. 3 strokes of the cat. I don't punish through pain. I punish through compassion, through kindness, making them happy. So this is stopping ill will towards yourself. Allow yourself to be happy. You deserve to become enlightened. You deserve that bliss. If happiness comes up, don't be afraid of it. Don't think, I don't deserve this. Indulge in the happiness. Enjoy yourself as much as possible. Bliss out. You deserve it. You made the karma. This is the result. Enjoy. It's like many people have made heaps of good karma in the world. Each one of you have made lots of good karma. Why not enjoy the fruits of the good karma? As I used to tell people, we've got so much good karma in our bank, in our account. The only problem is we've forgotten the PIN number to get that good karma out. This is the PIN number. Allow yourself to be happy. And then you're using and enjoying the fruits of your good karma, which is bliss. You've earned it, enjoy it. But there's also, even more profound, is the ill will towards your mind. Sometimes your mind is restless. Sometimes it's dull. I shouldn't be like this. I've been meditating for many years. It's ill will towards your mind. Where there's ill will, there'll be a battle. There'll be war. Every time you struggle, it's because of ill will. I don't want to be like this. Ill will towards the present moment. Ill will towards your mind as it appears in this moment. Ill will towards the state of your meditation. You can't abolish one hindrance by using another hindrance. Too often people try to overcome sloth and torpor with ill will. I don't want to be slothful. I don't want to be torpid. That's ill will. Of course, it cannot work. That's why I've been saying for the last few days, if you're sleepy, enjoy your sleepy. Allow sleepiness. The door of my heart is open to sleepiness. Because that is dealing with the problem without arousing other hindrances to complicate it. If you're slothful, if you're torpid, if you're lazy, you say, I don't want to be slothful. I don't want to be lazy. I don't want to be like this. That's called ill will. It does not work. The opposite of ill will is metta, loving kindness. The door of my heart's open to me. The door of my heart's open to my mind. The door of my mind is open to my progress in my meditation or lack of progress. That's why every one of you has come to the interviews, so you talk to me. I've never scolded you once. I've always encouraged you. Someone comes up and says, I'm so sleepy. I've been sleeping all day. I say, well done. Oh, it's so wonderful what you've been doing. I've been giving loving kindness to your hindrances. I do that on purpose, so I know it works. Ill will is the second of the biggest hindrances. Never, ever, any time, any place in your meditation, give ill will to what's happening. Give instead kindness, loving kindness. Doesn't matter how well you're doing or how well you think you're not doing. Allow yourself to be. The door of my heart's open to me. The door of my heart's open to my meditation practice. The door of my mind is open to this mind. It may be having the most weird of sexual fantasies. It might be planning murder. It might be planning or even worse things. Allow your mind to be. The door of my heart's open, no matter who you are, no matter what you're doing. Unconditional loving kindness. Don't just love your meditation when it's going well. To be able to love your meditation when it's going crazy. The door of my mind is open to this. Then you are not generating ill will. That's why those two are the big hindrances. Sensory desire and ill will. Check yourself. Make sure you never do those. The third hindrance of restlessness, sloth and torpor. Of all the hindrances, that's the least one you have to worry about. Do not fight sloth and torpor with ill will. Don't try and get rid of it. Don't try and struggle. Don't make a war with sloth and torpor. Overcome sloth and torpor with loving kindness, with stillness, with not doing. I mentioned this a lot in the last few days. I won't linger on this. Sloth and torpor comes when there's no energy left in mindfulness, because all the energy has been used in doing, struggling, fighting. There's no energy left to know. So, allow the energy, what energy is left, to flow into mindfulness. Don't waste even a bit of that energy in trying to stop things, change things, think things, worry about anything. Allow all the energy to gently flow into mindfulness. Be patient. After a while, sloth and torpor disappears all by itself. This is what happens. So that's why, of all the hindrances, it's the one you least need to worry about. The thing I've said in the interviews, Mahamoggallana was famous for his sloth and torpor, for his sleepiness. A few days later, he became fully enlightened, one of the greatest meditators, with amazing psychic powers. Any of you who have sloth and torpor, perhaps you have the same qualities as the future Mahamoggallana. The Buddha was walking in the forest one day, the other story I told in the interviews, with his attendant, Ananda. He saw a monk sitting dead straight, no sloth and torpor, perfect posture. And the Buddha said, I'm worried about that monk. Sure enough, 2 weeks later, that monk disrobed and got married. He went further into the forest. He saw a monk who was nodding, sloth and torpor. And the Buddha smiled. I'm not worried about that monk. And sure enough, that monk was enlightened within 2 weeks. An arahat. So all of you with sloth and torpor, only 2 weeks to go. You calm the doer. You calm the knower. It's only a matter of time before the knower becomes bright again. But don't struggle. If you struggle with sloth and torpor, as I said again yesterday, you'll just oscillate like a yo-yo between doziness and restlessness. Because you struggle, all the energy goes back into the doing. And then you're a doer again, restless, coming here, going there, never being able to be still until you run out of energy, and then you get into doziness again. Don't follow that track. Be kind, be still, allow the energy just to flow naturally by not doing anything back into the mind. It's nature. During a retreat like this, you'll be dozy the first few days. As the days carry on, energy comes naturally. You find you need to sleep less. You're more awake and aware. Sleepiness, doziness, is something which happens at the beginning of a retreat. If you follow these instructions, naturally it disappears by the end. And people find they're meditating long periods without any effort. They're not trying anymore, it just happens. They don't need to sleep very much anymore. They're more alert, more awake. Nature. Restlessness and remorse. Again, this comes from having too much control, too much doing. The only way to overcome restlessness is through contentment. Being happy to be here, no matter where that is. Like the monks in the monastery, even though it's austere, even though it's harsh, because they're happy to be there, they're content, they don't leave. You may have a painful body, you may have a restless mind, you may have a dozy mind. Please be content to be there. Whatever's happening today, in this hour, in this moment of your meditation, please be content. If you're content, you're at peace. If you're at peace, you don't need to go anywhere. If you don't go anywhere, you're not restless anymore. All restlessness comes from discontent. All discontent comes from a lack of appreciation of the quality of now. You've already done amazing things. You don't need to do any more. Rest. Be still. Don't go anywhere. Don't go off into the future, don't go off into the past. Be content, and all restlessness disappears. As contentment grows, you're so content you can't even think. All thinking is because of a perceived problem. You only think when there's a problem. When there's no problems, no problems left at all, there's no thinking left. When you really get content, you just can't think anymore. Why? Because there's nothing left to think about. What's there to think about anymore? You don't have to think about lunch. It's coming. You don't have to think about what you're going to have for lunch. Because it's two choices on our menu. Take it or leave it. That's all there is on the menu for lunch today. You don't have to worry about anything. Why think? You don't have to worry about your office or your work. Who cares? It's beyond your control. Don't think about anything. There's nothing to think about. In contentment, you're at peace. And the last of those hindrances is doubt. Doubt is another type of thinking. We will try to assess things and work it all out before we've got enough data to truly know. Is this jhana? Is this not jhana? Am I supposed to be doing it this way? Am I supposed to be doing it that way? Find out. How do you find out? Follow the instructions like a scientist. A scientist will never come to a conclusion until she has finished the experiment. You don't write your conclusion when only half the results are in. Nor does a judge in a court of law pronounce a verdict until both sides have had their full and complete say, until all the evidence has been presented. It's unfair, it's unjust, it's irrational to make a conclusion without all the evidence. So in this meditation, don't go thinking halfway to the meditation. What's going on? What am I doing? Is this right? Is this wrong? Wait until the end, when all the evidence of meditation is in. Then you have a much better chance of getting a fuller picture of what is occurring. This is why I ask meditators at the end of every meditation, the last 1 or 2 minutes, that's the time to assess what you feel like, what you've done. What's it like at the end of my meditation? How much peace, how much freedom, how much happiness have I got? And then, where has that come from? What have I been doing? Or what have I not been doing? It's like a debriefing after a journey. This is where you learn about the results of meditation, what peace, what happiness, what freedom truly are as experiences. And number two, you understand what works and what doesn't work. In this little talk on the hindrances, I've paid most attention to those first two hindrances because they are the most important. They are the biggest barriers. I have already talked a lot about sloth and torpor. I've only talked a little bit about restlessness and doubt because they are too overcome when you overcome the first two hindrances. But please know what those first two hindrances are. If you have any problem in your meditation, it's because of one or more of those hindrances. If you have that problem there, ask yourself, which hindrance is it? Do a checklist. Troubleshoot. Is it hindrance number one, number two, number three, number four, number five? Sometimes it's a number of those hindrances. Some people tell me I've got all five at the same time, continually. Don't be so negative. It's always one is the main one. One is the big one. So find out the biggest hindrance, the big problem. Find out what it is. When you've identified it, then you can apply the antidote. And you know it's the right antidote to the problem when the problem disappears. This is how you overcome those hindrances, how you achieve jhanas, how you see things as they truly are, when all those hindrances which distort reality are fully overcome. The abandoning of the hindrances. Any questions about what I've just been saying? Yeah. Well, using earplugs help. Sometimes it just irritates the ears with extra feelings. But if you do use earplugs, you still hear just the, you know, the sound, the hums there. If you're in a very, very noisy place, yeah, use earplugs. If you want to, if they're comfortable. But the best earplug is not paying attention to the sound. Nothing to do with me, not my problem. Leave it alone. Don't disturb the sound. Then the sound doesn't disturb you. Any other questions? Okay, remember there's no questions this evening because we're having so many questions still to answer. So no more questions this evening. Yeah? Okay, now if restlessness comes, the only directive thought you're allowed to use with restlessness is kindness, contentment. Just ask yourself, why am I restless? One of the thoughts which I used in the past, which was very helpful, was ask, what do I want? Because all restlessness, you want something. What do I want? Then afterwards, if I get that, am I going to be happy? The answer is no. If I ask you now, what do you want? Do you want anything? If you want nothing, then you aren't restless. Then you're free from restlessness to wanting nothing. If you want something, you'll always be restless. Contentment is not wanting anything. So to overcome wanting, you can actually ask yourself, what do I want? What do I want? If you want jhanas, and this is no one way to get it, give up and you get all the jhanas you ever want. If you want to eat, it's a waste of time wanting. Even if you eat, you only get hungry afterwards. You know, eating, it doesn't satisfy for too long, does it? You eat a nice meal today, you want another one tomorrow. It's endless. So find out what the silly thing you want. After a while, you find what you really want. It's just peace. You want freedom. You want happiness. So once you identify what you really want, you understand that restlessness is never giving you what you want. But it's stopping you getting what you want. therefore I give up restlessness. So you can use some directed thought. You can interrupt the taxi driver, but not for too much. I did give the simile the taxi driver, didn't I? Oh, simile the taxi driver. Suppose when it's time for this retreat to end, that you're going to go back to Australia with me. You decided to renounce to become a monk or become a nun, so you come back to Australia with me. So, you get a taxi, and they ask the taxi, please take me to the airport. But you tell the taxi driver, now I want to go this way, don't go that way. And please don't go too fast, don't go too slow. I'm a meditator, make sure you allow other cars to come in if they really want to come in, because I'm a Buddhist, I've got to be compassionate. Don't drive too fast, don't drive too slow. Now be compassionate, be kind, be gentle, and don't talk too much, don't do this, don't do that. By the time you get to the gate of this temple, that taxi driver will throw you out. He said, listen, madam, now I'll drive you to the airport, you just shut up and be quiet, I know how to drive. And of course the taxi driver's got all right to throw you out, because you keep on interrupting. You never allow the taxi driver to do his job. It's the same what we do in our meditation sometimes. We're always interrupting our mind. Come on, mind, go this way, go that way. If a thought comes in, the door of my heart's always open to it. Be compassionate, be kind. Don't go too fast, don't go too slow. Don't do it this way, do it that way. So your poor mind actually throws you out. It refuses to cooperate. So imagine your mind like the taxi driver. Just tell the mind what you want to do. I want to watch the breath. And then shut up. And allow the taxi driver, your mind, to take you to the breath. Your mind knows how to do it. If it's only given a chance, it will take you there with great ease. It'll take time. You can't just get to the airport in 1 minute. So give the mind time. Be patient to watch the breath. But don't go interrupting every second. Do it this way, do it that way. Don't do it the other way, do it this way. Ajahn Brahm said we can do it this way, but someone else said we should do it this way. Which way should we do it? I'll try this way. No, I'll try the other way. No, I'll try some other way myself. You never give yourself the opportunity and time from the mind to it. So you give instruction to the mind, and then be quiet and wait. If, however, the taxi driver does get lost, then you can interrupt it and say, look, this is the way. And the taxi driver, oh yes, sorry, yeah, you're right. But you don't keep badgering your mind. Don't give it too many instructions. Otherwise, your mind will throw you out. Will not cooperate anymore. So send me the taxi driver. Okay, maybe that's enough for now. This is some interviews now. So from 5 minutes down, 9:10 to just by 11 o'clock, interview time. So enjoy your meditation, check out your hindrances. If all those hindrances are gone, you're going to have the most wonderful meditation you've ever had. This morning might be your time. So please enjoy.